You're listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio. You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza right here on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Answers for the Family. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and each week I will bring you guests that can inspire, educate, and entertain while bringing answers and options to raising children today and in our constantly changing future. I will address issues such as locating a runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, and so much more. Now, having over 30 years' experience working with families in crisis, I've been fortunate to meet and work with some of the top professionals in many of the helping fields who are working to make this world a better place for all of us. And I'll continue to bring you some of these incredibly talented and caring people each week as we bring you Answers for the Family. Now, our guest today, Dr. Bernard Siegel, or Bernie as he prefers to be called, has touched many lives all over the planet. In 1978, he reached a national and then international audience when he began talking about patient empowerment. As a physician, Bernie embraces a philosophy of living and dying that stands at the forefront of the medical ethics and spiritual issues our society grapples with today. Now, in May of 2011, Bernie was honored by the Watkins Review of London as one of the top 20 spiritually influential living people on the planet. So he continues to break new ground in the fields of healing, supporting changes in the medical education to humanize medical practice. Now, Bernie attended Colgate University and Cornell University Medical College, graduating with honors at both. He trained to become a surgeon at Yale New Haven Hospital, West Haven Veterans Hospital, and the Children's Hospital of Pittsburgh. In 1989, Bernie retired from Yale as an assistant clinical professor of general and pediatric surgery to speak to patients, their families, and caregivers, and write. And writing he has done. Our topic today and the title of his new book is The Art of Healing, Uncovering Your Inner Wisdom and Potential for Self-Healing. Now, this long-awaited follow-up to his bestseller, Love, Medicine, and Miracles, updates Dr. Siegel's insights into the healing power of drawing, dreams, and intuition. Bernie, welcome to Answers for the Family.
Thank you, Alan. And I might start with, you know, all that you were saying about family, two things. One is that I've learned that the most significant public health issue on this planet is loving your children. If the children grow up loved, you don't have to worry about all the other things you mentioned, you know, teaching people how to deal with addictions and a whole host of things. Because if they grow up with self-love and self-worth, they take care of themselves. And they don't need a lecture because they know they're worth something. And I may add, as a simple way of knowing how your kids feel, because I'm doing this all the time in schools and, you know, with children who needed surgery and so forth, say to your kids, I'd love to have a picture of our house and family to put on the refrigerator and get them to draw a picture. Doesn't matter what age they are. Give them a full box of crayons because every color has meaning, and then let them draw it, and then quietly take a look at it so they don't realize you're analyzing them, because if they do, as our kids used to do, they'd slump over their drawings so I couldn't see them. But if they had a problem, then they'd come running to me. Dad, I don't know what to decide. What should I draw? But if I passed by their bedroom, you know, they would slump over so I wouldn't get any insights into what they were thinking about. But this way, you get a chance to really know, does it look like a family? Is everybody together? Because the teachers were always amazed. How do you know all that from that drawing? But kids are revealing it. You know, when a kid puts a solid line down the middle of the page and the father's on one side and the mother's on the other, you know there's a problem.
Right.
Or when, you know, nobody's near each other everybody's, you know, daddy's at work, mom's in the kitchen, my brother's in the bedroom, I'm in the front yard. It's not what I call a family circle, where everybody's embracing everybody else and touching everybody else. So they've got communication and every, you know what's going on in that family. And I may add just some other simple terms. I mean, if they don't have ears, are we listening to each other? If you don't have a nose, how do you breathe life? So take a look at it and see what your kids have to say to you. And, you know, then you can help them. Because just an example, which I think was in the book, a boy came to me and said, can you fix me? I said, what's the matter? He said, the kids are teasing me in the locker room in the gym about my body. And I said to him, draw yourself in the operating room, you know, that we'll go ahead and we'll fix it. And I want a picture in the, of you in the operating room. And again, they get a full box of crayons. That includes black, brown, white, and all the rainbow colors. And all he did was pick up a black crayon, draws a little table at the bottom of the page with what looks like an insect on it, and then writes me in black and a little note. I'm just very tired. That's why I did this. And I knew that's his excuse for the picture. You know what I mean? Intuitively,
right.
He knew
right.
This is not good. But you see, I show it to his parents then. I say, look how he feels about himself. Mm-hmm. I said, he needs your love, not a lifetime of plastic surgery. And again, it's not me criticizing the parents. It's their child speaking to them. I mean, another one, it's always hard for me to stop. Once I think of one, I connect with another.
Right.
A child with cancer.
Yeah.
And she came in the office with her parents and said, I don't get enough time for my family. Now, she's got, three siblings, herself and her parents. So there's six people in the family. And I, you know, I'm not going to sit there talking to six people who are going to tell me how wonderful they are and what they're doing. So I said, honey, draw a picture of your family.
Mm-hmm.
She drew herself sitting all alone in a chair. Everybody else is on the sofa, you know, with the parents' arms around, you know, the other kids. And there's an empty seat on the sofa, but she's not in it. And I showed it to the parents, who were good folks. I mean, they said, thank you. We'll go home and, you know, change what we're doing and give her more time. And it made a big difference to her. And the parents are very grateful. I mean, they weren't making excuses.
Right.
Those are good folks, you know, and they learned from their kids what they needed.
Right.
And
now,
all that is one more, and then I'll take a breath. Because I was just thinking, another person who was in the hospital, and I asked her to draw a picture. And she drew four windows. There's a cloud, and there aren't four windows in her hospital room. There's a cloud over one of them. There are three pretty things on the windowsill in each one with a number two over it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, what is that about? But then the next page, she drew a picture of her family.
Mm-hmm.
How many are in the family? Four, like the windows. She's way off by herself in the corner of the page. That's the cloud.
Right.
And there are three other people in the family. And what her mother had was a tray with two drinks on it. One for her brother, one for her father, nothing for her.
Mm.
And the numbers also are the way that we store things. I mean, we literally, well, Alice Miller, I don't know if you ever quote her, but our childhood is stored up in our bodies. And although we can repress it, we can never alter it. You know, our feelings can be manipulated, our body tricked with medication, but someday the body will present its bill.
Mm-hmm.
For it is as incorruptible as a child who, while still whole in spirit, will accept no compromises, and it will not stop tormenting us until we stop evading the truth. And that's something I try to get across to people. I don't care. You know, you could be 50, and I ask you to draw a picture and say, what happened when you were 21? And it was a disaster, say. Or one picture in there of a reporter who came to my office and I was not comfortable with her interviewing me because of her attitude towards what I was doing. So I said, draw a picture, then we'll sit down and talk. In the picture, she has a big head, which confirmed my diagnosis of her, you know, as an intellectual lady. But then there was a clock behind her with one hand pointed at 12. So I thought, I got to shake her up. And I said, what happened when you were 12 years old? Well, I don't like deadlines. I said, there's only one hand on the clock. And then she burst into tears and told me what happened. and that changes the interview. And so, you know, it is very obvious that we have all this stored within us. And if it's, you know, painful, guilt, shame, and blame stuff, it's going to affect your life and how you treat yourself. Study at Harvard. Did your parents love you? No. 35 years later, 98% of them had suffered a major illness. Did your parents love you? Yes. Closer to 25% had suffered a major illness. And they always say, if you go into an assisted living facility, 80, 90, 100-year-olds, you say, did your parents love you? They look at me like I'm nuts. Of course they love me. Ah, yes, they loved it. I said, I always say, yeah, that's why you're alive and here. And, you know, but yeah. You go into high school, you get the opposite. I mean, you ask high school students, write a suicide note, and you get a pile a foot high, you know, if you ask the class. And then you say, write a love note, and it's a couple of inches. And the kids know that. I mean, if you ask any high school student which pile will be higher, they'll all tell you the suicide. But let me add this so people don't get concerned about, you know, my telling kids I'd like you to do this for homework. Because when the school systems adopt it, the suicide rate goes down because the kids realize they're not the only one who's wounded, and they start talking to each other, and therapy happens. Rather than denying the abuse, they can now talk about it because they know they're not the only kid in the class that has it.
Well, I, you know, to sort of drive that point home, as you were saying that, it reminded me of I was at a program that worked with at-risk girls, and this particular program dealt with girls who had either attempted suicide or had some sort of threat or something to where the parents felt that they needed to go to this program. And I sat in one of the sessions, and I think there was 16 girls in the session, and the person, the therapist that was running the session asked a question and said, you know, how many of you believe that your parents loved you, you know, or love you? And only one raised their hand.
Yeah.
You know, so I mean, one out of 16. So there were 15 others that had attempted or talked about attempting suicide that obviously didn't believe that their parents loved them. So I think that really drives your point home.
Oh, yeah.
Now, when you were talking about that, one of the other thoughts that came to mind is that, is there an ideal age for having the children draw these pictures to be able to see, you know, what their feeling is towards the family? Is there an ideal age, or is it something that can continue
to grow?
No,
any age, yeah. I mean, because I put a lot of samples in. Mm-hmm. You know, you could be 4 or 5 years old, doesn't matter. You put the colors in front of them in a piece of paper, and, you know, if the kid picks up a black crayon, you know it's not the happiest kid in the world. Also, if there's, well, think of the rainbow. See, to me, that's the symbol of your life in order. As a matter of fact, in Solzhenitsyn's book, Cancer Ward, he uses the term self-induced healing, and it's a rainbow-colored butterfly that flutters out of this great book. And intuitively, he knows what I'm talking about. The butterfly is a symbol of transformation. The rainbow is your life in order.
Right.
So if your kid picks up the crayons and make this nice arrangement of colors, you know, bright colors, healthy colors, you know the kid's doing okay. But when they pick up colors and, you know, twirl them and whirl them, and you look at the picture and it's just, you know, it's like a mass of pieces of string all tangled together, you know they got an issue in terms of their life. Now, I have to admit, that you need to know that they had all the colors available, because I always think of this boy who came into the office with a black drawing, and I said, you know, I'm concerned about you. What's going on here? It's all black. Mm-hmm. He said, I have two older brothers. That's the only crayon they give me. So I said, okay, I'm not worried anymore. But, you know, so you need to know. Or, like, two of our kids, twins, I mean, were born with a hearing impairment due to German measles my wife was exposed to during her pregnancy. And so if they left their ears off, that is can be a statement. Yeah, I have trouble hearing. Not, I don't want to hear what my parents or the doctor or somebody's saying, but I have a physical impairment. So again, as I say, you need to know the person, the family. It's a lot harder if people email me a drawing, you know, and we're not sitting in the room together talking about it, because then I just have to send them questions and ask for explanations about things.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I could, you know, when you talk about numbers, if you could have four birds in the picture, and somebody might say, oh, yeah, that's there are four people in my family, and somebody else might have a different answer why that number meant something to them. So the dialogue helps, and the person who drew it is the expert, if you know what I mean.
Right.
It's not telling me, me telling them, you know, what this means, that means. It's my suggesting things so that it brings forth from within them what's going on. I mean, example, on a personal level, what got me started on this was drawing a picture for Elizabeth Kubler-Ross way back when, in the late 70s. And she started asking me questions about my life. I thought, I drew this, you know, picture I made up, an outdoor scene, and you're, where'd all this wisdom on your part come from? And an example, I put a mountain in with snow on it. And she said, Bernie, what are you covering up? And I was dealing with a lot of emotional issues as a doctor, you know, all the things you can't fix, cure, et cetera. And I said to her, why are you asking me that? She said, you put snow on the mountain. I said, well, it's a mountain with snow. What? She said, Bernie, the page is already white. You took a white crayon and added a layer. So what are you covering up? Mm. And, you know, that really opened my mind to going back to the hospital with crayons and getting not only the kids but the adults to draw pictures as well, to help me know them, make diagnoses, because the body speaks also through you know, symbols and drawings, and I could take better care of them by, you know, seeing their images.
Right. Now, and when you say that, obviously it helps for you to know more about the family, and let's take your picture, for instance. If that was just, you know, emailed into you, you know, you would then want to talk to the family, and let's say that, you know, that that was a, you know, a 15-year-old that drew it. But if he was an avid snowboarder, you know, would that then change your thought process?
No, not the added layer. You see, I mean, because the page is already white. You don't have to put white on top of white.
Okay.
Or if somebody made gray or pink, you know what I mean, that they're hiding their, you know, grief, let's say, or their emotions under that by toning it down. So there are symbols in all the colors, and white is basically a cover-up. You know, when you're drawing the picture, because you don't really need it if you've got a white piece of paper already.
Sure. Now, and one of the things I noticed in the books, and you talk a lot also, besides the drawing, you talk a lot about words. So, you know, what do you mean when you say words can kill or cure?
Well, especially with the children, it really impressed me. I was an authority to them. They had faith in me, because they also trusted their parents bringing them to me. And so I realized my words had a lot of power over them. And one of the things that helped me see this, too, was one of our children coming home from school in an art class. He took the word words and filled the canvas with it. I got it hanging on the wall here. And if anybody listening to this just writes words, 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 with no space between each word, you realize the words become swords. And when he brought that in the house, I have to say, as a surgeon, I looked at it and thought, wow, I could kill a cure with words or a scalpel with swords. Now, why do I say that? Because if you're an authority figure, you have a hypnotic effect on the people you're talking to, and especially if it's authority figures talking to kids. And the thing that woke me up was something useful, because in the emergency room, I would say to the kids, to reassure them, you'll be going up to the operating room, and you will go to sleep when you go in the operating room. Now, what am I thinking about? I'm thinking about anesthesia. You know, you'll go to sleep, You won't be, you know, you won't have pain. We'll take care of you. We'd get up to the operating room, wheel the kids in on the stretchers, and they fell asleep on the stretcher. It blew my mind. You're wheeling a child into the operating room, and they fall asleep.
And because you planted that seed. You planted that seed, so they
fell right into that. Yeah, they taught me, in a sense, if my words are that powerful, let me say things that will then help them. I now call it deceiving people into health, you see, because I started, you know, the alcohol sponge. When somebody's going to draw your blood, they clean your skin.
Mm-hmm.
I would say to the kids, oh, we got some new sponges here. They'll numb your skin so you won't feel the needle.
Mm-hmm.
And then the fear was gone. They'd sit there, put their arm out, draw the blood or start an intravenous, and they'd say, that's great, thank you. Why don't the other doctors do that? Now, that's a third of the kids had anesthesia from my comment. See? The other kids would say, I felt it. That didn't work. You know, but it was a different response. You know, it wasn't panic about a needle. It was, I felt it. And I would say, oh, it must have been a bad sponge. I'll make sure we get a new one next time. So, you know, they didn't know I was tricking them, so we could, you know, still induce a different reaction with it next time. But it really helped them to feel better and have, you know, less pain. And I say, nobody's against you deceiving them in a useful way. And what I would tell a lot of parents, because I saw this happening too, take vitamin pills and put a new label on the bottle.
Mm-hmm.
And when your child says, I feel nauseated, you know, say after chemotherapy for cancer treatment, here, take a pill, this will cure your nausea. They told me my hair is going to fall out. Oh, we got hair growing pills, you know, and you give them hair growing pills. And it's amazing because, again, the kids have faith. You know, if you try to do that with an adult, they probably look and say, yeah, come on. But the kids have faith. My parents are giving me this. The doctor said it was good. So it's amazing, again, how many side effects are diminished or, you know, completely removed because of what they're taking. You know, we call it the placebo effect when
sure.
people believe in something. But again, if you use it in a constructive way, oh, it helped the kids enormously. That I played also nursery rhymes and music in the operating room for adults as well as the children. But, you know, the kids just felt a different spirit. And everybody in the room became like a kid. You know, when you're playing children's music in the background before the surgery and during it.
Yeah, now that sounds a little bit like, I think, what you refer to in the book as the paradox technique.
Yeah.
I mean, why don't you give an example, you know, of the paradox technique.
Well, the paradox is saying the opposite, you know, of what people are really looking for. You know, if people, you know, even if it weren't medicine, if somebody came in and said, oh, my business is going to fail, and maybe it'll last another 3 months, and you said, ah, you're lucky if it lasts 3 weeks, they'll give you a different look, you know, and yes, you might even get a smile. And so, yeah, I could say that to people who said, I was told I have 2 months to live. I say, ah, you probably got 2 days. Then they look at you and get a different attitude, you know, yeah, maybe you're right. I could be more than 2 months. And one lady, which was a specific example, was very fearful of surgery. And I tried in a, you know, what do you call it, an intellectual way to mm-hmm. stand next to her in the hallway in the operating room and discuss everything and take away her fear, but it didn't work. So I said, we have to go in the operating room now. And we wheel her in. And she said, thank God all these wonderful people are going to take care of me. You know, the nurses, the anesthesiologists, everybody standing around, my assistants. And I thought, if I agree with her, it's not going to do any damn good. She's saying it to try to help herself. So I said to her, look, I've worked with these people for years. They are not wonderful people. And for about 10 seconds, I thought she was going to run down the hallway and leave. But then she knew he's kidding, and she burst out laughing. Of course, everybody in the room was laughing because they know the kind of character I am. So everybody's laughing. Nobody's insulted. And we were family in that moment, you see. And I'd say that's what the paradox does. Well, listen, I always say I don't make up any of these stories. Mm-hmm. I was the police surgeon in New Haven, Connecticut for a number of years. One of the policemen whom I knew, a fellow named Jim, he calls me up, and I'm in the office. I answer the phone. He said, "Dr. Siegel, what is it, Jimmy? I'm going to commit suicide." What are you going to say then? You know?
Mm-hmm.
I figured if I said lots of nice things and, you know, I love you, don't do that, what the hell's that going to do? You know? So I said, "Well, Jimmy, you commit suicide, I'll never talk to you again." And I hung up the phone. About 15 minutes later, he came barging in the office. And he was a former professional football player. So this is this enormous guy comes crashing into the office, runs through the, you know, waiting room into my office. And I thought, he's going to flip you out the window, you know. And he just starts screaming at me. "You, what kind of insensitive, ridiculous person are you? I'm sitting there with a gun in my mouth and you say this stupid..." And, you know, after a few minutes, I said, "Jimmy, what is it? Did you notice something?" "What?" "You're not dead." And then he realized, "Oh, you're a wise ass, you know. Mm-hmm. You did that on purpose." Yeah, what else could I do? But by saying something like that, he ended up not committing suicide, and we became lifetime buddies.
Right, yeah, and what you're saying is that it's a timing situation. In most cases, you know, we want to continue to reassure people that they're loved, that they're valued, that they're respected.
Mm-hmm.
But what I hear you saying is that there's going to be times in which people are in fear, and while they're in that fear, you know, you can snap them out of it a little bit. Now,
well, you can't be afraid while you're laughing.
Yeah,
I mean that literally.
Exactly.
Good. Let me mention, because you were talking about families, and the kids learned to say to me, "Dad, you're not in the operating room now."
Mm-hmm.
That was like their paradox. You know what I mean? When I became overbearing. And the line I loved, I don't know who it came from originally, but, "You know why your mother and I will never get a divorce?" Because we have five kids, and sometimes they're driving me nuts. "Do you know why your mother and I will never get a divorce?" "Why not, Dad?" "Because neither one of us wants the children." And then they knew we better quiet down, you know. And you see, we could laugh at what each is saying to the other, but we also took it sincerely, you know, to know that they've reached that point where you got to, you know, get back to being a father again and not the head surgeon in the operating room.
Yep. Well, we're going to take a break. We will be right back. Please stay with us. We are talking with Dr. Bernie Siegel, and we are really just focusing on a lot of the things that you can do to heal yourself. You know, it's all about healing and ways in which we can heal ourselves. Stay with us. We will be right back.
Founded over 25 years ago, to meet the needs of families in crisis, Westshield specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, Westshield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you.
And we're back. You're listening to Answers for the Family. We're talking with Dr. Bernard Siegel, and the subject is his new book, The Art of Healing. Now, one of the things I want to share is that if you're at your desk or whatever, obviously not if you're driving, but you can go to the website, which is www.berniesiegelmd.com. That's BERNIESIEGELMD.com. You can follow along with us. You can check out the book. There is, you know, it really does have a lot of things that helps you in regards to uncovering just inner wisdom and your own potential to self-heal yourself, which I think is great, because here we have a doctor that became more focused on how we can heal ourselves rather than trying to make everybody believe that you have to go into the doctor to make it happen. So, first, Bernie, I appreciate that.
Thank you. It's that's why I love the word potential. It's what we're capable of. And I talk about mottos to live by, because there are a lot of people who say, you don't know what mottos I'm dying by. And what I mean by that is what they heard from their parents. You know, you're a failure, you embarrass us, you'll never amount to anything. But when you grow up with parents who can say to you, do what will make you happy. Difficulties are God redirecting you. You know, material things that make it a better world, then you don't, in a way, have what I call the wrong Lord. You know, you're not hearing the wrong voice directing your life. You're really following your heart, living your life, not losing it to the desires of others. And it just makes such an enormous difference in your life. And you're enjoying it and living it rather than resenting and bitter and all the things I see people going through. And when did they wake up? When somebody says, you have a life-threatening illness. Oh, then I'm going to go home and do, you know, what feels good. And I may add, I tell people to become a love warrior, because there are times the child can change the parents.
Mm-hmm.
Two people. One who had parents who were alcoholics, committed suicide, and told their children to kill themselves, and said they didn't love their kids enough to not kill themselves. She's still alive. In a sense, I reparented her, listened to her, made her feel worthy. But a quote from her, when I let love into my prison, she starts a letter with, I had no control over the parents who raised me or the circumstances I was exposed to. But when I let love into my prison, it changed every negative item in it, meaning the experiences in my life, and turned them into something meaningful. Now, another young woman, she heard me talk about love all the time. I said, yes, tell your parents every day I love you, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And she kept coming in to me and saying, they don't answer, they don't say anything. 3 months went by, and she persisted in saying, I love you every day before she left the house. She came in with a big smile. I said, what happened? She said, I was late for work this morning. I ran out of the house. My parents are in the street screaming, you forgot something. I said, I got everything. What did I forget? You didn't say I love you today. And then came the tears and the hugs. And I tell you, love is a real weapon. And when you use it, you change people. Because, again, you know, your parents had parents too. I mean, it's who do you blame at some point? Well, don't blame anybody. Make the change now. Reparent yourself. Even reparent your parents.
Mm-hmm.
I tell one kid changed me and taught me something, because she was a suicidal teenager, and she said, you're my CD. I said, what are you talking about? I'm a CD. She said, you're my chosen dad.
Wow.
Boy, that was such a gift, and she taught me something to just say to kids, hey, you need a father, I'll be your father. I mean, it doesn't even matter. You know, it could be somebody older than I am, but it's letting them know that I love them. See, I may not like what they're doing. I make that clear.
Right.
I'm not talking about liking. I'm talking about loving.
Mm-hmm.
Those are two very separate things.
Well, and you bring up a great point, and it's one of the things that we do, and when we're transporting an at-risk child, and we will tell them, you know, they'll start yelling, oh, you know, I'm going to hate my parents forever for doing this. And I said, please understand, you know, your parents are making this decision out of love. You know, do understand that they love you. If you want to hate something, you can hate the deed. You can hate the fact that this is happening, but understand that the decision is still being made out of love. So I completely understand.
Yeah, I was reading something the other day I thought was interesting. The someone was going to a Zen master, you know, the line, if you meet Buddha, kill Buddha. Huh? If you meet your parents, kill your parents. And if you meet your instructor, kill your instructor. And then he went on, of course, to explain what he's talking about, that understand you're equal to Buddha. It isn't that Buddha is some special person. You know, I always say it's like we're all God's children. Mm-hmm. You don't really physically kill your parents, but you eliminate what they did that's hurting you, whatever it was, their words, their actions, anything else. And the same with your instructor. You know, you don't put everybody else on pedestals. You belong there, too. You're equal to all of them. And we have to realize we can, that's why I like the word eliminate. We can eliminate our problems. We can eliminate diseases. It's built into us, and we have to call forth that potential. I mean, our body has to know that we like living. Monday right. morning, okay, mm-hmm. more heart attacks, strokes, suicides, and illnesses. It's a very simple, clear example of what happens to you when you don't like your life. And the other thing is that when you continue to be bitter and resentful of others, and I learned this mostly from a robbery of our hotel room one night. Mm-hmm. My wife and I went to dinner, came back to our room, it had been robbed. And it wasn't broken into. I mean, a key was used. Right. So it was obviously people working for the hotel, knowing, you know, the hotel, everything else. And I had seen this weird-looking guy in the hallway. And I'm sure he was waiting for us to leave our room and then went in and stole things. And I kept picturing him and, you know, resenting him and wanting to get even with him and being back in the hotel. And I realized, this guy's still robbing you. You're spending, you know, that's part right. of your every day thinking about him. And it was about this time of the year, too, Thanksgiving, Christmas. And I thought, you know, maybe what he robbed, he pawned, bought his kids a Christmas present. And then I felt better. And I thought, if I see him, I'll give him a couple $100, make sure he really gets something good for his kids. And then I'm smiling. You know, you talk about paradox. It happened in my own head.
Yep.
I wasn't really thinking about it. Just this crazy thought came in, and now I'm willing to give him more money so he does something nice. And I was free from that moment on. And when one of our sons had his garage robbed, and I happened to show up there one morning to visit him, and he's on the phone to the police, and I, you know, angry as hell, and I said, calm down, the guy hasn't bought his mother a birthday present in 10 years. Now that he's robbed you, he can get his mother a present. And our son looked at me like I'm out of my mind, but he shifted from the anger to a smile also, you see. And then it's hard for him to think about the robbery without thinking about his crazy father, and I did him a big favor by shifting that, you know, belief system and attitude.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think you bring up such a great point, because we're allowing ourselves to be, in essence, violated twice. You know, the first time, yes, we've something, you know, tangible or whatever was taken away. But then to allow them to rob our quality of life for the right. next weeks or months or whatever, that's the real damage. So I couldn't agree with you more that if we can get more people to look at things that way, not that it makes it okay that people do those things, but we have to take care of ourselves. And I think you bring up such a great way to do just that. Now, I know when we started, we were talking about drawings and stuff and things you could pull out from drawings. Now, we've talked a little bit about words and how these words can damage us or they can help cure us.
Right.
Now, I know in the book you talk a lot about visualization. So let's talk a little bit about the visualization that you use as a cure.
Well, I'm not sure what you meant by that. But what I'm telling people to do, often when I say if somebody has cancer or some other disease, draw yourself, your disease, your treatment, and your immune system, eliminating the disease.
Right.
Now, there are people who will have more disease than immune system. The treatment isn't even entering their body, all these things. You know, or they're not accepting the disease. I mean, some people will draw four different pictures instead of one, or put the disease on another part of the page. Then how do you, you know, if you're not accepting it, and I'm not talking about accepting what a doctor predicts, accepting the disease so you can be empowered to affect it. So I can look at the pictures with them. Like one lady wrote on the page, you know, I have millions of white cells, and she drew about six of them, and you know, 10 times as many cancer cells. So that's her intellect. You know, she's trying to impress me. I'm doing a good job, but the picture doesn't show it. So when somebody literally drew the devil giving them poison as treatment, they're going to have every side effect in the world.
Mm-hmm.
How can I change that? For instance, one lady drew herself in the operating room. It's a black box. She's lying on a, everything in the picture is black, a table with only two legs. There's nobody else in the picture. It's an empty room. I said to her, then don't have surgery if this is how you feel about it. But she said, no, I want to go ahead. I do like my doctor. I said, all right, then we have to change your beliefs. I want you to go home and four or five times a day, picture yourself going to the hospital, having surgery, waking up, doing beautifully, hungry, no pain, et cetera, and, you know, discharge quickly. A week later, her drawing is gorgeous. I mean, it's, you know, filled with color, doctors all around her caring for her. God's light is shining into the operating room. Her family and her husband are all around the operating room. I mean, it's just a beautiful scene. And there's four legs on the table now, not just two. You know, she's got more support. So I'm not worried about her having surgery then. And let me say, just so people understand why this is so significant, where doctors have made errors that they didn't realize were happening, where a radiation therapy machine is repaired and they don't put the material back in, and the doctor doesn't know that, when they think they're giving people chemotherapy, but some nurse made a mistake, didn't put it in the IV, et cetera. But the patients, see, the doctors, I heard these stories because the doctors were telling me how terrible they felt. They just found out they hadn't treated anybody. And I said, you don't understand. And they said, what do you mean? We're telling you we feel terrible. I said, that's not the point. I said, you didn't know you weren't treating people.
Right.
Because they all acted as if they were. And I always picture this one doctor saying to me, oh, my God, you're right. Because he was, you know, feeling so bad that he hadn't done any, irradiated anybody. But I said, your patients were having side effects of treatment, skin getting red, tumor shrinking, because they thought they were. And that's the power of the mind. See, why we wanted to get people's intellect. And, you know, in other words, their conscious mind as well as their unconscious mind to be integrated and have the same beliefs and desires, so there's no conflict in them. Because where there's conflict, where you're going for treatment,
right,
and the part of you is saying, I don't want this, you know, this is the devil giving me poison kind of thing, you'll have every side effect in the book. But when you're saying this treatment is a gift from God, and I mean that too in the drawings,
right.
I mean, God can be the source of x-ray therapy, beautiful pictures, or you can look like you're a skeleton lying in a coffin under the machine. So all of those variations occur. But when it's a gift from God, then what I call your labor pain isn't significant pain, and you're happy with the result because it's helping you to survive and rebirth yourself.
So how do you teach the doctors to advise a patient that you know is going to go through, you know, some pretty heavy, like, chemotherapy? How do you train the doctors in how to explain that to them? Because on the one hand, you know, you hear all of these horror stories and all the things that they have to say, you know, that's pretty negative. How do you train them to bring up those things that you're talking about now so that their clients can really get their whole mind and their whole being behind this becoming a positive thing for them?
Yeah, you'd have to put me in charge of medical education in the United States. I mean, that's the biggest frustration I have about this whole process, and why I was so happy that this book was published with 70 drawings in it, hoping that doctors will take a look and see things that they might not have believed otherwise. I have never met a physician who has ever been told while in medical school that Carl Jung interpreted a dream and correctly diagnosed a brain tumor. When I read that, it was like, wow, why didn't anybody tell me that? And then when I began to see patients putting their anatomy into drawings, because I'm a doctor, I know anatomy. Mm-hmm. A lot of art therapists don't see the anatomy. They're looking at psychological factors. I thought I was discovering something incredible. But all the medical journals said it's interesting but not appropriate. The appropriate journals said it's appropriate but it's not interesting. We know this. And it's this horrible division of medicine into all these specialties. Mm-hmm. I always say what I began to think about was it's the doctors are treating a lot of people like they're a house, you see.
Right.
Meaning that if your electrician, you know, needs to come in, they repair that. But you don't ask your electrician about the plumbing. You know, everybody, you know, each problem has its specialist. And, you know, people are beginning to be treated that way. See, there's an ad
right.
that I show on a slide when I lecture. It says, I was depressed. I went to see my physician. I said, you've got to help me. He prescribed an antidepressant. See, I feel better now. I wrote to the New England Journal of Medicine, Sandoz Pharmaceutical Company,
mm-hmm.
a few years ago. I said, excuse me. I've had a tragedy in my family and I'm depressed. The doctor doesn't even ask me what's going on in your life. He just hands me a pill. Could you put another sentence in your ad that says, tell me what's going on in your life? And they cancel the ad. Now, you know, that's the sad part. You know, what I call medical information is what we get in our medical school and training. We should be getting a medical education. We should be taught about how to take care of people. And let me mention, two of the drawings, see, I showed two extremes. I say to a class of medical students, and to doctors too, draw yourself working as a doctor. You would not believe how many drawings do not have a human being in the picture, only all the instruments and things. Or the most common drawing is, I'm sitting behind my desk with a diploma on the wall, you know, I'm saying I'm a doctor, and there's no patient in the room either. The one that touched my heart was a young man who drew himself kneeling in front of a lady in a wheelchair, his arm around her, handing her a tissue. See, he knows that's what being a doctor is. I mean, I had my father-in-law was quadriplegic, and he would say, my forehead itches. So I say to people, what do you do if somebody is quadriplegic and says their forehead itches? Everybody's answer is, normal people say, you scratch it.
Right.
But no, when you're in an institution, they give you a pill, see, to cure itching,
mm-hmm.
which puts you to sleep and, you know, makes you basically a dead human being. If you're paralyzed and sleeping, what the hell's the point of being alive? And yes, I raised a little hell about it.
Mm-hmm.
And to try to wake them up to the fact that this is a person, you know, you're not just treating an itch. Look at the individual. Treat the experience. That's the part I learned. And I would say to everybody listening to this, if you have a problem in your life, think of the words you would use to describe it for other people. And I don't care what the problem is.
Mm-hmm.
You could have lost your job, have cancer, migraine, headache, a divorce. What are you going through? And then take any words that have a negative meaning, like pressure, burning, draining, constriction, confusion, and ask what else in your life fits those words. And then work on healing your life and whatever those words refer to, and you will find you get healthier and feel better. Now, there are a few people who will say things because they have lived the experience and say, oh, I had a wake-up call, a blessing, a new beginning. And those are life-threatening tragedies because they have realized that, like hunger makes you seek nourishment, when they had that pain and that problem, they sought help and nourishment, and it helped them to heal.
Wow.
It became a gift.
Bernie, thank you. I wish that we had more time. The book is The Art of Healing. Bernie, thank you so much for coming on.
If
you decide to run for Attorney General, let me know because I'm ready to support you.
Okay.
So.
Yep. And let me say, you're an exceptional male because one of the hardest things is to get men to come to support group meetings and to share their feelings, and even to accompany their wives, whereas the women always come when the husband has a problem.
Well, thank you for that. And again,
okay, thank you.
You're welcome. And for everybody else out there, please listen to this audio and donate and be back with us again next week. Thank you.
My name is Darnell Young, and I'm desperately reaching out for help. In 1970, after a blood transfusion, my mom contracted hepatitis C, which later evolved into terminal liver cancer. A transplant is her only chance of survival, and we don't have the means to fund the surgery. My stepdad's working as much as he can, and I just got off chemotherapy myself, so I've been limited in what I can do. Any amount you could give would help our family more than you can possibly know. You can go to our fundraising website at youcaring.com. That's youcaring.com, and search One Family's Battle, ONEFAMILY'S BATTLE, and you can donate directly there. Don't forget to capitalize the first letter of all those words. Thank you.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza, right here on LA Talk Radio.